This week's show and next week's are both concerned with rebuilding the American dream. And this week, I'm going to speak with Rob Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and next week, Van Jones, who is part-time at Princeton, part-time at Campaign for America's Future, but is really spearheading Rebuild the Dream. This is big work, necessary work, challenging work that's going to demand wisdom, will, and action of us all. I first met Rob Johnson when he offered a powerful and energizing talk and slideshow in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, and I immediately asked him to join myself, Richard Eskow, and Drew Dellinger in a conversation that took place on Free Forum August 14th, 2 weeks ago, in which we really looked at the very big picture and about the American dream, but really also about the stories and the narratives and the myths and so on. It was really as I said, I think we started at about the 5,000 foot look at what's going on, and at times went higher than that. And I invited him back this week to engage me further and deeper about his vision of what's broken, how it got broken, and how we fix it. And though we will talk about more than his work at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, I think it's worth knowing what he is dedicated to there. And this is a quote from their website. When the economic system breaks, it spares no one. But such a crisis can provide an opportunity to work together to create real, lasting change. This is one of those times, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform economics as we know it. The havoc wrought by our recent global financial crisis has vividly demonstrated deficiencies in our outdated economic theories and shown the need for new economic thinking. Prevailing theory that the economy is an idealized system of perfectly rational individuals and institutions who, by trading in markets, produced a balanced, efficient equilibrium has been rendered obsolete, and a lot of people got hurt in the process and are still getting hurt in that process. A more realistic view is emerging that takes into account the imperfections in individuals, in institutions, in information, as well as the existence of the complex global networks of interaction and the dynamics of innovation that change the game as the game is going on. So the Institute for New Economic Thinking's mission is to nurture a global community of next-generation economic leaders, to provoke new economic thinking, and to inspire the economics profession to engage the challenges of the 21st century. As I said, we will talk about that, and we will talk about other things as well. Robert Johnson serves as director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. He also served as chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. He was an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side about torture in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was a management director at Soros Fund Management and is now, as I said, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, funded by Soros to encourage and support a rethinking of the fundamentals of economics. Welcome again, Rob Johnson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Although we touched on a little bit, I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to talk about. You've been a management director at Soros Fund Management. That's really dealing in the trenches of big finance. You've also been chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee, and in your answer to this question, tell us under whom. But tell us a bit about those two experiences and how they impact your path to your current work.
Okay. First of all, when one works, the old saying, I think it was Bismarck, you never want to see sausage or legislation made. And
yep.
When I was with the Senate Banking Committee under the leadership of Bill Proxmire, I had the opportunity as a young man to work closely on issues like the 87 stock market crash, what caused it, how to remedy that, and the preparation for the impending savings and loan crisis and bailout. And I would say what I learned there is that contrary to some ideologies, politics and economics do mix. They are intimately intertwined. The economic system and the market system is not something that's mutually exclusive and off to the side. And the people in the private sector spend a great deal of energy, time, resources studying and trying to influence the structure of government policy to create subsidies or what you might call competitive advantage, what Dean Baker calls a nanny state. The work that I did with Soros was portfolio management. I was focused largely on foreign countries and particularly emerging market countries in Asia. And there one is really what you might call trying to discern reality, and you use economic theory to the extent that it's a good guide to learning and predicting what's happening and what's unfolding. I think economic theory, well, if you said what were the key learnings from that period, I'd say two. The first is there is nowhere near as much stable structure and understanding of the future in reality, what you might call in the eyes of the investor, as there is put in these economic models.
Sure.
Models have a false sense of structure and precision over time that really just is not a useful guide to how things operate. The second dimension, which is perhaps related, is that economic theory, to make things mathematically feasible, tractable, doable, presumes stability of the financial system. And the regulatory designs presume that logic accurately describes financial markets. I see no basis for believing that financial markets are inherently stable. I think they're very competitive. I think they're very psychological, and lots of people striving to get an edge, and they're playing leapfrog, and they're reading each other. But the idea that these things are somehow anchored in some solidness or stability and therefore do not require structures, regulation, certain things being off limits, little bits of prior restraint, seems crazy. And what you see is that when we get into a period like the bailouts in 2008, things are going over the cliff. All the financiers jump up and say, oh, my God, you have to bail us out. Otherwise, we'll take the economy down with us. Well, right in that instant is the admission that there are side effects, what economists call externalities, where the spillovers that harm everyone else done by finance are something that should be taken into account in regulatory design, and they are not. So I guess I'd say the Soros experience of markets, market instability, is complemented by understanding how the regulatory process works and the disproportionate role of private power in setting the rules for themselves to the detriment of society. Those are the things I primarily learned.
Very good. That's the voice of Rob Johnson. He's director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute and executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. You can learn more. And I will say this web address more than once during the show. You can learn more about his work on new economic thinking at INET Economics, I-N-E-T, and then the word economics, all one word, ineteconomics.org. When I saw you speak at the Hammer, certainly your introduction was as the executive director of this, this institute to come up with new economic thinking, but your talk was really very much on what has happened to the American dream, how it's happened, and some things that are absolutely necessary if we're going to begin to restore it. And as you probably heard at the top of the show, I'm interviewing you this week, Van Jones next week. I think it goes in keeping with the interview that I did with the three of you 2 weeks ago, really trying to get a handle on kind of that big question. In terms of your focus and the best use of our hour, the American dream, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, how would you like to approach the two?
Well, I'd actually like to spend most of the time on the question of the American dream.
Very good.
The Institute for New Economic Thinking, which I manage, is designed to develop what you might call a change in economics in a 20-year time frame. We hope to affect the conventional wisdom, having seen how bad the conventional wisdom was in the approach to 2008, particularly regarding financial economics and some neglected issues like inequality, which are now very much in the forefront. But I came to the Hammer Forum, where we met, really working more from the work I do with the Roosevelt Institute, the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute in New York, and the title of that series, not my title, but theirs, was Restoring the American Dream. I think there are an awful lot of aspects of applied economics and things that I learn about through INET that can be applied to that. But let's focus on what are the things that have deteriorated and what are the things we want to rebuild in America so that people feel optimistic about their lives and their children's lives.
Okay, and that definitely is in keeping with where I am going this fall, I can tell. Let me set up by some thoughts that I, in preparing for this, some thoughts that of my own that I want to share with you that I didn't share 2 weeks ago. Some of it will sound similar. I'm disappointed in how we're doing as a nation and as a global society. I expected us to be more serious about the challenges we face, about what a successful society offers and asks of us, about the responsibility that comes with enormous wealth, power, and influence, about our responsibility to our children in the future. And I sometimes wish, this is something I really feel, that I could pay less attention to politics. You know, I have friends, some of a more libertarian bent, aware, spiritual folks, conscious folks, who put their faith in sort of social entrepreneurial efforts outside of politics, who think that politics is a con game, everybody's a crook, it's a necessary evil, but nothing to put our hopes in. And I appreciate that perspective, especially with the current dysfunction in politics. But I believe, and clearly from what I've seen of you, that politics has too much power for us to actually successfully work around it. And I, as I said 2 weeks ago, I believe that ever since television advertising became the dominant activity of campaigns, politics has more and more come to be owned by the super rich and the biggest corporations, especially finance. Politics in return works for them, builds a system that meets their desires, and it's a self-perpetuating vicious cycle. And the political and economic system that results is not delivering. It's not meeting the needs of a 21st century society in terms of health, education, work, treatment of our children, seniors, nature. We're not investing sufficiently in our future or the future of the planet. We're wasting time, money, attention, energy, and ultimately the lives of millions. And I know in the midst of this, great advances are being made in all sorts of arenas, but the big picture looks troubling and challenging. How much do you share that perspective?
I share many, many aspects of it, nothing I particularly disagree with.
Yeah.
I was originally trained as an engineer at MIT in Boston, and we learned just a simple concept of feedback systems.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So you're designing something like a carburetor for a car, and when the humidity changes or the temperature changes or what have you, what you want to do is change the fuel mix. Well, at some level, the feedback from the results of society to changing the rules, regulations, and so forth that govern our society is broken, in meaning we are not getting proper feedback that takes care of our society. We proceed along, like right now, imposing austerity on everybody at a time when one in six people is unemployed, underemployed, or discouraged and fallen off the scrolls. And we are not making healthy decisions. Some of the reasons I think that feedback doesn't work has to do with concentration of money and wealth. It has to do with concentration of power in corporations as distinct from individuals, what economists talk about as the principal agent problem, where you can't control the people that are running the company when you're a stockholder, and corporate executives want to have all the rights of a person, but they don't want to be prosecuted when they do things that a person would be put in jail for. So I think we have problems in corporate governance. I think we have problems with money in the media, money in elections, and how that relates to the incentives for survival by politicians who have to sell their policies. And I, as a matter of fact, if you said to me, what is the core reform that has to take place? And I heard you speaking at the outset about people devoted to the spiritual and other concerns. We have to change how rules are made for our society by changing the role of money in politics because that feedback system is broken. And I would love to go back to seeing everybody put their philanthropic energies into art museums or water purification in poor countries like, in, say, in parts of Africa, or supporting the arts. But right now, time, energy, and money has to be devoted to politics until it's repaired.
Very good. I've heard you do a big picture analysis of the motivation for austerity measures in the face of weak demand here in the U.S. and growingly more so in Europe. And let me see if I've got it right. You said that the banks took so much of the public's wealth that that cuts have to come from somewhere. And since they control politics here to a huge extent and to Europe, maybe not quite as much, but far too much, the adjustments are not going to hit them. A speculation tax, other taxes, tighter regulations, but it's going to be taken against those least able to fight. Can you explain to people more sort of how austerity is on the ascendant when we're in the middle of a deep and perhaps deepening recession?
It's pretty close to terrifying and befuddling that when all kinds of people in the construction business are laid off and our roads and bridges and schools and the energy efficiency of our buildings is sorely lacking and everyone knows it, we don't take those idle resources and put them back to work repairing and modernizing that infrastructure. It's pretty close to criminal and defies common sense. And furthermore, a lot of the infrastructure that's allowed to atrophy and deteriorate will cost much more to repair eventually. The old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
And let me cut in for a second, Rob. Another piece of why it will cost more in the future is that in a time of recession, in a time when the vultures, we'll talk about this more, I know, the vultures are looking to get things on the cheap, public investment would be cheaper than it will be if we were robust.
That's right. That's right.
So now's the time.
People are desperate, and governors, the mayors, and so forth are desperate to make their finances balance. They do things like the Greek government did when it wanted to enter Europe. They create fancy derivatives that hide what's their real fiscal condition in order to get beyond the next election or beyond the threshold where they can enter into the system or abide by the rules that they need to. That's a real problem, but a deeper problem is when you're in the throes of crisis with a little bit of campaign contribution from financiers and fund managers, mayors, governors, state legislators, municipal legislators can often be influenced to sell public infrastructure in what's called a privatization, where a private company then operates this monopoly system, like a toll bridge or a highway system or the parking meter system, which is the famous case in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they can charge monopoly prices, make very high profits, and there's nothing protecting the population that these privatizations are done at a fair market price. These privatizations are put up to auction, maybe, where two or three big oligopolistic financial institutions are the people bidding. They probably collude and discuss it among themselves and keep their bids low. Number two, the advent of, supporting reelection. We've seen the case the governor of Wisconsin try to propose legislation where he could sell off power plants at whatever price he felt. And there'll be no recourse, no legal challenges, no auctions or anything. He could just hand out candy to his cronies. And this is the kind of privatizations that we saw in Russia after the collapse of Soviet communism, where people who were essentially apparatchiks, skilled in the mechanisms of backroom politics, became billionaires instantaneously without doing anything for the betterment of society. It's not on that scale in the United States, but this fiscal austerity at the state and local level threatens to cost us all more. And as you mentioned earlier, banks and financial investment funds see the potential to benefit from this austerity.
And what I was pointing out also was, by the same token, government investment right now would be wise because prices are low. Because we're in a downturn, correct?
Yes.
In other words, whatever you're going to invest, if you invest it when the economy's booming, everything will cost you a little more. If you invest it now, when we need both the jobs and the investment, you will also get public goods cheaper rather than just, as we point out, the vultures getting stuff cheaper.
That's right. You'll get them cheaper and you'll finance them at lower interest rates.
Yeah.
With a robust economy, government borrowing competes with robust private borrowing, and we can get, higher interest rates that cost everybody in the private sector more. When you have idle resources, a slack economy like we have right now, that is precisely the time to engage in the public infrastructure rebuild.
If you ask the public, they want higher taxes on the wealthy, higher taxes on corporations, cutting defense, investing in infrastructure, all the things which at this moment seem to be also what's needed, and yet the Washington and to some extent even the state houses don't seem to be listening at all. Is it that finance has developed that much more power that they control what even gets near the table?
I would say Dick Durbin, senator from Illinois, coined it very aptly when in the middle of credit card legislation in Washington, he said, well, we can't get anything done. The banks own the place. So as a first approximation, yes, I think they are the largest donors. This is a very interesting question. After the resentment and the hostility that's all over the polls about the bank bailouts and bonuses, when Rahm Emanuel goes and runs for mayor of Chicago and he has to be replaced, the Obama administration considered it an intelligent move to bring the number three executive, Mr. Daley, in to run the White House staff. Now, I'm not talking at all about Mr. Daley's skills or experience. He's a former Commerce Secretary, very able man. But the optics of bringing a leading bank executive in to run the White House, right in the face of the American people, tells you about how powerful that financial sector is and how important money is in successful presidential reelection.
Exactly. I know we're going to concentrate on the American dream, but one of the things which I do want listeners to get the benefit of is your understanding of the global picture. Let's divert for a second here to talk about why austerity. We sort of look at America and we can say, okay, you know, it's these ridiculously expensive campaigns we have, and so finance has too much influence, and that's why we're where we are. What is doing the same thing in Europe?
I think that in Europe, it is a slightly different mechanism. The way I just tend to describe it is you have Germany and the peripheral countries. And Germany agreed at the time it was doing unification between East and West Germany after the Berlin Wall fell, that to reassure people in Europe, given the history and adversarial relations between Germany and other countries, that they would join a common Europe. What they did was they issued the equivalent of an insurance policy, which is everybody's debt is now European debt. Everybody subscribes to this tough anti-inflationary monetary policy of the European Central Bank. It was built on the model of the German Bundesbank. They put rules in place they called the Maastricht criteria based on a meeting that took place in Maastricht in Denmark. What's happened is when we experienced the downturn, those countries, particularly Greece, Portugal, to a lesser extent, Ireland, because they made banking guarantees that took them from very prudent to insolvent almost instantly. and by the way, those insolvencies reflect holdings by American, British, and German banks, so they're under international pressure not to default on those guarantees. But at any rate, all of those peripheral countries in this downturn start to pay benefits for unemployment. They start to lose tax revenue with the slowdown in the economy. And their fiscal credibility has come into question. And the Germans are like an insurance agency that at the outset they joined Europe And they essentially, they wrote those policies. But now that there's an accident, there is political turmoil within Germany that says, maybe we don't want to be part of this anymore. And all of the anxiety among financiers is really underlying a question. Does Germany, the strong creditor economy, back Europe, or are they going to walk away from Europe? And if they do walk away, then all of these bonds that have been trading like they were all part of the European system become every country for themselves. Interest rates will skyrocket, what they call risk premium. The risk you pay as a premium on the interest rate will skyrocket. The German backing, and to that extent, to the same extent, French, Dutch, and other backing will dissipate. And a full-blown crisis, probably some insolvencies and debt restructuring like in a bankruptcy would ensue.
Now, so there what you say really is the key there is Germany.
And if it's Germany and German, the stability of German politics, because you have three to four parties always vying to be in the coalition, the Free Democrats, the Liberals, the Christian Democratic Union, and the Social Democratic Party. And you have a population which was, in their history, 20s and 30s, scarred very, very powerfully by hyperinflation and monetary mismanagement. And they do not, in any event, want to go back to such a violent place.
Okay. And what's the temperature right now? In other words, on the one hand, Germany has done certain things. But are you saying it's just done too little, too late, too begrudgingly, so that rather than putting the full force of its power into turning this around, because of their internal politics, they keep doing a little bit here, a little bit there, and the crisis is only going to get worse? What do you think the next 6 months hold?
Well, let's start with a little bit of history. In 2008, during the crisis surrounding Lehman Brothers, everybody in the major countries said, we cannot have any banks go bust. But in Europe, Angela Merkel from Germany stood up and said, that's right, but every nation guarantees their own banks, as opposed to Europe jointly and severally guaranteeing all the banks.
Uh-huh.
And so that made, say, Irish banks and other things instantly not part of a system. It'd be like if you had a bank headquartered in the United States in North Dakota, and all of a sudden you're not backed by the full faith and credit of America, you're backed by the taxpayers of North Dakota, and let's say you're a bank as large as Citibank, instantly that's not credible. So that's where the fault lines opened. They could have, in early 2009, done preemptive restructuring and fortification of Germany, Portugal,
Greece, Ireland,
and Ireland.
Yeah.
And an ounce of that prevention would have been a pound of cure. This system has now migrated through indecision and half measures for almost 2 years. And, I mean, they tried a first vision of a plan, and the European Financial Stabilization Fund was announced in May of 2010. And they just keep not doing enough to the point where it's now infecting Spain. It's infected the bond spreads even of France. It's very much affected Italy. And in many ways now the Germans are being pushed that if we don't unify fiscal policy, come up with a common European bond and a United States of Europe, this whole thing may smash apart. And the debate now on whether to have that common European bond, which is quite unpopular, is, how would I say, rests again on what will the Germans do.
And your guess?
I had been of the mind that German banks, who are also politically very powerful, had lots of holdings in Spain and Italy and France, and ultimately their self-interest, or their collective self-interest, you might call it, mm-hmm. of that sector, would lead to encouragement of a euro bond. What has concerned me in recent days is that the European Central Bank has started a bond buying program, meaning the European Central Bank is buying Italian, Spanish, and other bonds from banks, including the German banks, which diminishes their interest or the necessity of this restructuring. So I'm a little bit concerned now that the ECB, the European Central Bank, is actually doing things that calm things in the short run but make it harder to get a proper long-run architecture.
Ooh, I see what you're saying. In other words, a new sort of half measure. Were they sort of spurred to that because they got impatient waiting for Germany to finally move? But now, as you say, what that may do is make it less likely that Germany will.
That's the question.
Oh, my God.
The question is, will the Germans now go ahead, or will we have anesthetized the concerns of the German financial sector with this central bank bailout, and as a result have socialized the losses inhibited the response that the German banks should have had to make the system hold together.
Right. And another case where the longer you delay, the higher the price. I mean, even if they do move in and even if they do what needs to be done, the price keeps going up, doesn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. The scale of the operation is much larger at this juncture.
Let me allow you to sort of give listeners the brief version of your talk at the Hammer, that is to say, you know, the big questions that you felt necessary to take on and the big evidence in that you presented in terms of what's wrong and what's needed.
Sure. By the way, the video podcast of that talk has just come online. I sent the
You did, I looked at it this morning. Is that an – I guess if people want to find that, go to the Hammer – oh, gosh.
Hammer Forum, I think it is.
Yeah. And then just look for – and then they all of them show up there. They have video of all of them, and this one just went up, but I highly recommend it. They're moderated, by the way, by Ian Masters of KPFK.
Right. So my talk, very quickly – they give me the title, Restoring the American Dream. So I started with the word restore. What needs to be restored implies something's been lost. Somehow we're not as well off or confident with the structure of the system presently relative to the past. And the thing that I identify in the talk that's so markedly different from, say, the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, is that as our economy grows now, two-thirds of the gains are being taken by 1% of the population. 10% of the population is taking more than 100% of the gains, and 90% of the population's living standard has been going down since 1978. I then looked at the consequences. So establishing, the first part was to establish the increasing inequality in data and pictures that one can see. The second is to look at evidence that really comes from epidemiologists and others on what are the consequences for society of inequality. You could say there's rising inequality, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. But the evidence is overwhelming that more unequal societies exhibit very, very negative social pathologies. Higher obesity, higher murder rates, higher incarceration rates, higher infant deaths, lower social mobility, higher school dropout rates. And this evidence cross-sectionally among the 50 United States based on income inequality in the states, and that evidence across the spectrum of countries.
Now, I'm going to interrupt just a second because I really want to emphasize this. I had the authors of The Spirit Level, who did a lot of the research you're referring to, on here. I highly recommend the book to anyone who wants to get a big picture of what's been going on. But in case people didn't hear it, what that says is that when the countries with the greatest inequality, or in America, the states with the greatest inequality, suffer across the board. The wealthy do not do as well as the wealthy in states or nations that are more equal. The poor do worse. And by the way, Rob, one of the ones, you know, so you go, oh, okay, obesity, health, mental health, that makes sense. But even innovation, which is one that you'd say, oh, well, that's one of the things, but we've got this, you know, cowboy culture, and so people are eager to innovate. Innovation is also something. Patents per capita also track with equality. So I just want people to look up the spirit level, and that book, and this is, this I felt was a major contribution, because it's kind of, you know, maybe a sense people have, but they did the research.
That's right. And there's a website that your listeners can go to, Equality Trust, all one word,
that's
equalitytrust.org.
Right. Yep.
But the other one, which I thought was the punchline slide, is that social mobility is down when inequality goes up. Now, that's common sense at some level. Wealthy families can give their kids all the advantages, and when you don't have a lot of what you might call public goods, libraries, parks, and things that we all can enjoy, people in the lower rungs have a harder time getting up to those levels of high functionality and success thresholds. And people who have advocated a free market, unbridled, no progressive income tax, no inheritance tax, have to grapple with the fact that the data is very strong that social mobility, the equality of opportunity, as they call it, is diminished when the starting conditions show widespread inequality.
And if we go back to what we're talking about, which is the American dream, social mobility has always been one of the essential praiseworthy traits of that American dream.
That's right. And restoring that, when you say, what do I think needs to be restored? Priority on equality, or diminishing the ranges of inequality from where they are now, which is wholly unacceptable, to more acceptable levels, and restoring those rungs in the ladder so that anybody can have the faith that if they do their best, they can succeed in this country. And in the United States now, the capacity for social mobility is much lower than almost every industrial country in Europe. It is much lower than the Scandinavian countries, and it's much lower than Japan. And that's a big change. And a very negative one.
Yeah, and one of the things that I would say, as I would imagine both of us have been looking at this over the years since the Reagan and Thatcher revolutions and so on, and you sort of thought that tendency of the American middle class and lower middle class to, through their belief in the American dream, through their belief in social mobility, to kind of keep thinking that we're fine because we've got that I never would have imagined it would get this bad before people would wake up.
Well, I think we've had an enormous failure of leadership. And what I would say is that the wealthy and the affluent have largely acted like corporate managers whose only responsibility is to their stockholders in their companies, and not to the architecture or vision of what constitutes a society. That questions like public education and broad-based health care and housing, the things that all Americans, after suffering the Depression and after fighting together in World War II, understood were necessary conditions to a healthy society. Now, in that era, people of color, and to some degree women, didn't get carried along for the ride. We also needed, and it's been one of the healthier dimensions, we need to broaden that everyone who is an American is part of that American dream. And that was a failing at that time. But the notion of what constitutes a quality life and a quality society, and using the economy as a tool in service to society, rather than tearing apart society in service to the economy, is something that we have to work hard to reinstate now. And that's why I say to your friends who are more spiritually or libertarian-minded, we have no choice but to engage in politics at this time.
Yeah, that the crisis is such that this ship has to be turned around. It needs the energy of every able-bodied person on deck. Then maybe return, you know, to those other venues.
Well, towards the end of my talk, I mentioned the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphor I used was looking at the audience. I said that I'm very concerned, like I know they are. And one of the reasons I came to give the talk, one of the reasons I'm talking with you today, is that I feel like well-educated, well-meaning people today are all on the deck of the Titanic. And we're looking at the captain, we're looking at the navigator, and we're saying in the communication between our eyes, are we going to help these guys avoid the ice? Or am I better to try to get the jewels from the safe and the food from the galley into my personal lifeboat? And I think it's time that American people have to understand that that frightened, individualistic response is going to continue to destroy the system that we were very proud to be born into and grow up through. And we do need collectively now to stand together and cooperate and avoid the rocks, or in this case, maybe dig the boat off the iceberg and repair the hull.
Very good. That's the voice of Rob Johnson. He's the director of the Project in Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute and the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. You can learn more at ineteconomics.org. You can find the talk we were just talking about by going to the website of the Hammer Museum and looking for Hammer Forums. I want to talk a little bit about the politics of this. A European friend pointed out to me how amazed he was that in the U.S., or, you know, just how strange it seemed to him that in the U.S., one of the two major political parties and maybe half of the political energy is not about how to use government and public service, but how to weaken or eliminate them. And that there are conservative governments conservative parties and conservative politics in other countries, but seldom is it to that extent, right?
Yes. I would say there are two things that I'd like to emphasize.
Great.
To listeners. The first is we have to have an argument about the proper scope of government, broad versus narrow, and we have to have an argument that's a separate argument about the strength of the civil service. Are they weak or are they strong? And I would argue that whether you choose broad scope of government or a narrow scope of government, you need a strong civil service. You need everyone to be fortified and supported like Navy SEALs are supported. You need financial regulators at the SEC to be well-paid, well-trained, supported with budgets, supported with resources so they can do their job and enforce the existing laws. And we have a tremendous confusion in this fight between those who, what you might call, advocates of the social contract that resemble the New Deal and the more conservative groups that would like a narrower mandate for government. And what we have right now is a stated relatively broad mandate that's not in effect because we have a weak civil service. And this confusion feeds back onto the public because they keep coming up with examples of malfunction by government. But the Securities and Exchange Commission cannot possibly, or the Commodities Futures Trading Corporation, or the FDIC, cannot possibly execute their mission, given that campaign contributions are coming from financial firms to congressmen and senators, asking them to weaken the budgets of those institutions.
And let's not, I mean, that's the obvious one because that's Wall Street, but OSHA.
In healthcare, in OSHA.
EPA, FDA.
Yep.
All of those. Yeah, one of the things that really occurred to me last night as I was thinking about this, Rob, is that the Republicans have their hand on the scale. You know, at a butcher shop? Because they want to shrink government. They want the people to favor shrinking government. And at the same time, they have a great deal of control over whether government succeeds or not.
Yeah, they create a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly.
I want to get, you know, I started my career working with Pete Domenici in the Republican Party.
Oh.
And on the Senate Budget Committee. I don't really see this much as Republican versus Democrat. You know, I talked a little bit earlier about Obama appointing a White House director who was a banker.
Right.
Republicans do exactly the same thing. It's about the logic of money raising and survival. It's not an R versus D philosophical issue that any voter can hang their hat on. Both parties have this problem. It is an endemic problem of the incentives in our government. When I look at that problem, which I thought was very well characterized by David Sirota in his book Hostile Takeover, mm-hmm. basically how the Beltway and moneyed interests work against all of us, I am not upset with the diagnosis of people like the Tea Party, because in essence what they're saying is the government acts like a golf course where we all pay the dues, but only the rich and powerful get to play the course. It acts like an insurance agency where the wealthy and the powerful can mitigate their losses on the back of ours and our children's tax burden. And if that's the trade-off, tolerate that system or cut it off, I can understand why those people want to cut it off. The problem we have is that societies that do not manage the provision of their collective goods, their infrastructure, which is the proper role of government, because of this lack of trust, those societies become less productive, less satisfying, talented people migrate away from them, and they wither. So the idea that the Tea Party people are disappointed in government, I share.
Yep, same here.
The prescription for how to remedy it, which is essentially just take it all apart, I disagree with vehemently.
And so that piece that you said, which I think one of the reasons you emphasize it is because it gets said so seldom about having a strong civil service. One of the things that I know you pointed out in that talk, and I've seen pointed out elsewhere, is that what a regulator coming out of college, let's say, versus someone going into a private firm straight out of college, back in the 50s, their income was very similar. And now it is it's the difference between the help and the boss.
And it gets not even just when you come out of college. 15 years later, senior people with great skill and great education and knowledge of finance might make $175,000 to $200,000 in the government, and they might make $4.5 million a year working on Wall Street. So regulators who have to take care of their families and everything else, perhaps unconsciously, but they may not be as tough on behalf of the public, because at some point they want to take out their resume and walk across to the other side and use their expertise where they're making in 1 year they're making what they made in 20 previously.
Right. In other words, they may work in regulation until their kids get to college. Or work in regulation until kids get it. Now it's the choice between public high school and private high school, and suddenly they're gone. But what you're saying is that that status difference, that income difference, may affect their work all the way along.
Yeah, or it may affect the vehemence with which they're willing to confront the regulated on behalf of the taxpayers who are paying their $200,000 salary, because they know if they burn those bridges, vis-a-vis those people they regulate, and they do a tough job and an appropriate job, they may not be a candidate for hiring in the future.
And that's leaving aside the fact that the private sector may be doing its best to lure the best, the most talented, the wisest, the cleverest all along, and winning that battle because they can afford to pay so much more.
And by the way, there, you know, people talk about these things in the abstract, but I would encourage people to look at the government of Singapore, where they give support for the absolutely highest levels of training, like, you know, PhDs at Harvard or MIT or Cal Berkeley or Stanford, to their civil servants. They pay these people like $600,000 a year to $1 million a year. They give them ample budgets to execute their mission. And they tell them, if we catch you committing fraud, playing monkey business, we'll throw you in jail. So they have all the carrots and all the sticks to have a dignified, meaningful, resource-laden ability to live a life and execute the mission on behalf of the public. This is not a pipe dream.
Right. And what we're talking about here really is that on the one hand, you have how the rules are set, and on the other hand, you have how the rules are enforced.
Correct.
And what we're doing is we're losing both battles. Right? And you're saying that if you separate the two and you merely say, look, let's admit that the referees and the umpires have to make enough living that they can rule against those well-paid players, that should be separate from how broad a mandate you think government should have. That if government is going to be effective, but then that goes back to that thing I said, where if you have a self-interest in government not being effective. But let me jump to another question, which I know concerns you as well, which is, you just pointed out the Singapore example. I often turn to the German example. Germany with 83 million is either number one or two exporting country in the world. And yet, a company with 2,000 employees, half the board is elected by the workers. When it came time, when they suffered employment hits, they didn't lay people off. They did a national program of people working a little less.
Work sharing, yeah.
Work sharing. All these things which make...
My friend Dean Baker in Washington, D.C., at the Center for Economic Policy Research, he's done some very good work illuminating that German system.
What I'm saying is, it isn't a question of socialism versus capitalism. There are ways that other countries have found to make capitalism work. And that is, by work, I don't mean work just for the shareholders or just for the wealthy, but work better. What is it about Americans that they are so ignorant, blind to what other countries have done to do a better job of the system that we have? I find it almost pathological that even American progressives don't know, for the most part, and don't point out the examples that are being carried on. You know, this is the real world. People are actually trying different things and getting better returns.
Yep. Comparative economic analysis is very important to understand what you might call which models are working the best. And we don't tend to practice that in America, where a lot of social science has devolved into essentially being marketing for the elite and powerful rather than analysis of the possibilities and trade-offs for society as a whole.
Okay. To turn this around, I watched an interview in which you were asked what should people be demanding, and I was struck by your answer. You said, number one, public financing of elections. Number two, media companies made to provide free time for public service information and election campaigns. That if you can't stop the flow of money, given Citizens United, that you can limit the need for it in elections. Now,
that's
for
right.
Years, actually, I've been saying the same thing, that the only way we're going to get the health care, the education, the environmental actions that we want is if we actually all, despite those, you know, our particular issue, banded together and said, this is what has to change. How we finance, advertise, and maybe even how we actually run our elections is got to change first. Your thoughts?
I think that is exactly what you might call the common thread among all of these dysfunctions. And as you pointed out from my earlier video, reducing the extent to which an elected official needs to get money in order to be reelected is key. Because then it diminishes the role of money relative to the currency of votes. And if the currency of votes and efforts to invigorate participation and so forth, I mean, American voter turnout is absolutely dreadful by the standards of democracies around the world. Dreadful. Now, the question is, why is that? Some say, well, you know, they put obstacles in the path, particularly of minorities and others, so that they make them afraid to come to the polls or afraid to register. But the other dimension is, a lot of people, like you mentioned earlier in this program, say, I don't want to have anything to do with politics.
Yeah,
it's not even worth going over there and validating this system by casting a vote. Now, I find that a tragedy, and I'd rather you go take your hour and a half off from work or whatever, if you can, and go over there and vote and write in on the ballot just to participate as a citizen. But a lot of people say it doesn't matter. because the big money corporate process essentially creates a menu at the restaurant that I would never want to order from.
Okay,
I don't want to eat any of those dishes.
Yeah, Rob, I've got to close it at that. Let's do this again in a few months. That's Rob Johnson. He's executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. Their website is INET, I-N-E-T, economics, one word, ineteconomics.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that both at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're both the same website, or at iTunes. And you can also, at my site, sign up for a weekly announcement, tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background on the issues. Or you can do that by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Finally, thank you to Rob Johnson, and keep up the good work.